Hello and welcome to Musings on Sports, where great storytelling is our passion. I'm Kelly Elbin along with Bob Bupka. Robert, we are 4 weeks into the NFL season. We've got a lot to talk about there. The college football season continues on. We've got a big game this weekend with Texas A&M going to Tuscaloosa to play Alabama. And our guest today, Ian Eagle, I think people are going to love his storytelling. His father, by the way, was Brother Dominic in the Xerox commercials back in the 70s. And Ian's kind of a chip off the old block. He was a lot of fun to talk to, Bob.
Yeah, he really was. And the one thing that I came away with, and I think our listeners will too, is the amount of preparation and the amount of information at his fingertips when he's doing a game. You'll be amazed at the stats and facts that he has so that he can educate the listeners. And boy, I don't know if anybody does a better job than Ian Eagle.
Yeah, you're right. The preparation really struck me as well. And I think that's why he's been part of the CBS broadcast team for 25 years with their NFL package on Sunday. He and Charles Davis are really good together. Speaking of the NFL, I've always loved the NFL, and I've got a bit of a love, not love hate, but love and some concern with the NFL. The love's easy. You look at the quarterback play, and you look at what Pat Mahomes did in that Sunday night game against the Buccaneers. You look at Josh Allen and his just his strength of running over people and eluding the pass rush, making big plays, almost willing the Bills to victory. Lamar Jackson, very much similar to that. But the concussion situation and what we saw with Tua Tagovailoa and even with Cameron Brait, the tight end for the Buccaneers on Sunday night, this is a situation. It's a very violent game, and it's played by very big men. And the NFL, I think a lot of us really believe the NFL had a better handle on this, but the situation with Tua is one that became very, very uncomfortable with what happened in Cincinnati. They've got a lot of work to do, Bob.
Oh, for sure. And it's a tough situation the way I look at it, Kelly, because, you know, first and foremost, the player wants to play. So he's going to be saying whatever he can say to get back in there. He'll almost push his personal health aside, which is not a good thing. And then the team doctors, they want to make sure if they rule him out that, you know, it's a legitimate rule out, because they don't want the team coming back at them saying, why did you keep our quarterback out? He could have very well played. So I don't know the answer, and I don't think anybody else does, Kelly. It's just one of those things, and it's so dangerous, as you accurately pointed out. You know, it's a violent game being played by awfully big men that are awfully quick and awfully powerful, so injury is always going to be part of NFL football.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter whether it's 2022 or 1962, but in 1962, they didn't have the eyes from above who could spot things. They didn't have the TV coverage where it was obvious. You know, the eye test on this. I mean, you can see as a fan when Tua gets up in that the game against Buffalo on that Sunday afternoon after he got pushed to the ground, and he's wobbly. And you know, they deferred to it as a back issue. And then the Cameron Brait situation on Sunday night, where he inadvertently ran into his own player, and you could just the sound of it, and he came off the field. He then went back on the field and played for three downs before the end of the first half, and then he went into the concussion protocol at halftime. And even Tony Dungy, former coach with Cleveland or with Tampa Bay, who's now with NBC Sports, was on the sideline working the game, and he called the system a broken system. Bob, they have to get the situation tightened up considerably. This cannot continue to be an issue with the NFL.
I've been noting how they have been experimenting with real safety helmets, and they're using them in practice. The preliminary reports are coming back favorable. I predict before long you're going to see players wearing a completely different looking helmet. And I think that'll cut down the concussions by a drastic amount. And That, I think, will be very good for the NFL.
Well, great point. And, yeah, they've utilized them throughout training camps. They look funny, no question about it. But safety always should be the number one priority. Big game in college football coming up. The Alabama and Texas A&M in the offseason, there was a big verbal feud between Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher. Texas A&M under Jimbo kind of limping in to Tuscaloosa. They lost by 18 points to Mississippi State. Alabama is trying to continue on. They are the top-ranked team in the country. They haven't looked as strong, but I have a feeling that Jimbo could be in for a long day against Nick and the Crimson Tide, Bob.
Yeah, Bama looking as powerful as ever. Big difference with the Alabama football team than most teams. If they're starter goes down, the replacement probably would have been a starter on any other team in collegiate football. So they have a rather easy transition from starter to replacement with no significant drop in talent.
College football is big business, and we've known that for a long time, and the situation in Wisconsin is one that caught my eye. Coach Crist, the coach there who had done well in the last few years, was fired after a 2-3 start, and the university, although they reduced the buyout, they're going to pay Paul Crist $11 million to no longer coach at Wisconsin. And that money, by the way, is coming from the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bob, which is the school's fundraising organization. It's not coming from the university itself. So, you know, when you make coaching changes in midseason at major programs, it's something that they don't, you know, no program wants to do that, but the money's available and it's a big business, and guys being let go, no different in a lot of ways than NFL coaches being let go in midseason.
Well, the only thing I can think of that's better than being paid $11 million to do your job is to be paid $11 million not to do your job.
Show me the money, right?
Unbelievable.
Hey, I've got a good buddy, Sean Walker, who works for the Philadelphia Phillies. I know he's a happy guy. Today, the Phillies have ended an 11-year drought of not being in the Major League Baseball playoffs. They clinched that with a victory last night. And good for them. They've got a lot of good players. It looks like they could be playing the New York Mets, perhaps, in the first round of the playoffs. The Mets really collapsed against the Atlanta Braves, being swept by the defending champions in a weekend series. Braves obviously have a lot of tools, a lot of ability, pitching wise, et cetera. But I do wonder, when it all comes down to it, certainly in the National League, you have the Dodgers, who are, if they win the last two games as we record this, they're going to finish 112-50 on the season. Unbelievable year, and they've got all the makings of a championship team.
Yeah, from top to bottom, the L.A. Dodgers are the best in baseball. But when you get in these short series,
yeah,
and even the World Series, 4 out of 7, no guarantee that the best team wins. That's what makes, or part of what makes, the World Series so very exciting.
Also happy to see the Seattle Mariners end the longest drought in Major League Baseball in terms of not being in the postseason. First time that they've qualified for the postseason since 2001. And it's good. I think that, you know, to have that is important for baseball. I don't like to see teams that go a long time that have, you know, great fan bases and suffer and not have their teams reach the playoffs. So good for Seattle. But again, I like the Dodgers a lot. The Yankees will be interesting. Their biggest story here in the last couple games, can Aaron Judge get that 60-second home run and move ahead of Roger Maris? It's really been cool, Bob, to see Roger Maris' son traveling around with Aaron Judge as he's tried to exceed the single-season home run record that his dad, Roger Maris Sr., set in 1961. Not every son would be doing that, but a lot of class in terms of Roger Maris Jr.
And it's all attributed to the class of Aaron Judge. He is very talented as a baseball player, but he even has more talent being a team player. Everybody on the Yankees, there's no animosity, there's no jealousy. They're all rooting for him to get that 60-second home run. Time is running through that hourglass, pretty fast now, and you've noticed a lot more frequent walks being issued to Judge. It's almost like every pitcher doesn't want to be associated with giving up that 60-second home run.
Yeah, I don't blame him. Never good to be part of history that way. A little bit of history as well. This Sunday, going back and finishing up before we get to Iron Eagle with the NFL, they last week they played their 100th game overseas. Really good, dramatic finish with the Vikings beating the Saints. And then the Packers and the Giants will be playing in London this Sunday. Aaron Rodgers and the Giants. Be a good matchup. The Packers haven't been as good as maybe some had thought. They did squeak by and beat the Patriots on Sunday. But two great franchises to be able to be playing overseas. I'm sure the crowd will be a huge one there in London.
Yeah, and what's fascinating about watching those games in London, the fans are, you know, predominantly, well, they call it football, we would call it soccer, soccer fans. So the kicking game is, you know, they're very keen on the kicking game, much more so than a fan in the United States. But you're right on the money there, Kel. Packers, Giants in London on Sunday. I can hardly wait.
Yeah, and I can't wait for our listeners to hear from Iron Eagle. He really impressed the heck out of us, as you mentioned, Bob, about his preparation. And just as a storyteller, his mom was a singer. His dad was a stand-up comedian in addition to doing acting with, I mentioned, the Xerox commercials. But you can see somebody like Iron Eagle, the preparation. He's got a great voice, and he loves what he does. I think that's the positive nature that he has and the team element that he brings to broadcast. You know that, Bob. Whenever you're in an environment where everyone's working together as opposed to one person or two kind of being, you know, a little put off, it makes a huge difference to the whole.
Well, teamwork works very well on the field, equally so in the broadcast booth. If a couple of guys get together and they're both knowledgeable, they certainly can put out a great football game over the radio.
Well, I look forward to everybody hearing from Iron Eagle, and you'll hear from Iron right after this commercial from our good friends at Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover. The smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin and Bob Bupka here. And Bob, what a treat to welcome in our special guest today. At this time of year, you hear him on Westwood One's radio presentation of Thursday Night Football. And you both see and hear him and his broadcast partner, Charles Davis, call NFL action on Sundays for CBS Sports. The busy man that he is, Iron Eagle, thanks for your time and welcome to Musings on Sports.
My pleasure. Kelly, Bob, great to speak with both of you.
Listen, Iron, I've been dying to ask this question. You've covered so many sports and different sports, and you're great at all of your coverage, very versatile. Do you have one favorite sport that you like doing?
Oh, Bob, the tough one right out of the gate. Like asking me to pick my favorite child. I couldn't do it. I couldn't go on record and say it. I think with the schedule that I've kept for 20-plus years of juggling assignments, football and NBA and college basketball, radio, TV, you really learn how to compartmentalize in not only your preparation, but your approach to each game, each event, each broadcast. And the one thing I truly pride myself on, I'm excited to be there and I want it to come across on the air. This is not something that I'm just squeezing in until my next gig. I take these jobs really seriously. I take the time that it requires to be ready for these jobs, the back and forth that you develop with your analysts, the dynamic of relationships and connecting. So the goal is to impart that on the air. And I guess that's why I've never really chosen a favorite. When I'm doing the NFL, I'm locked in. And if it's radio, then it's all about painting the word picture. If it's TV, it's about setting up your analyst and making sure that you're speaking to pictures and making sure that you're a conduit from the venue to people's homes or in their local pub, whatever it might be. When I'm doing NBA, there's a different rhythm to that broadcast based on the fact that these athletes are going up and down the floor at a breakneck speed, and you're trying to maintain your command of the action while also being informative and entertaining. When you're doing college basketball, completely different. The whole rhythm of the game is different, and the stories are really important for most of the athletes participating. This is the highest level they're ever going to play. This is a chance for them to make a name for themselves, and there's a chance for their families to hear those stories or hear about their background. Tennis, golf, very different. And I've just tried to really immerse myself in it from day one and try to be as one with the event that you're calling. That line has to blur a bit when you're calling these games where you're in control, but you're fully committed to what's happening in the moment. Doesn't matter what's going on in your life outside of those three and a half hours when you're on the air. Doesn't matter if your flight was delayed. Doesn't matter if you had a guy snoring in the room next to you at the hotel with thin walls. Nobody cares. It's all about the event, those athletes, coaches, teams, franchises, storylines, all of that is what occupies my concentration and my attention.
Let me ask you this. Like a typical week when you're doing two NFL games a week, what is your, you know, typical, just explain for our listeners what you go through in trying to prepare for two different games in one week.
Yeah, so to cut right to the chase, you're talking about 212 names that you have to commit to memory in some form, whether it's straight memorization and identification or familiarity, so that you can go on the air and do these games and do them at a high level. So that's the first thing, is getting yourself to a point where you're comfortable with the subject matter, where you know the players, you know the storylines. Then the physical part, for me, I still do all of my boards, which have the uniform number, the name, the height, weight, age, how many years in the league, what college did they attend, how were they acquired, how did they originally get into the NFL, how much money do they make, how many Pro Bowls have they been to, what background can you come up with on each player. I'm working on the Baltimore Ravens right now. Mark Andrews, the tight end, number 89, Pro Bowler in 2019 and 2021. His 2021 stats, 107 catches, 1,361 yards, 9 touchdowns. He signed a 4-year, $56 million deal. He is a red zone target. He was a high school wide receiver. He's diabetic. He won the John Mackey Award in 2017. He's among the best tight ends in the NFL. His ability, yards after the catch. How much of that will actually make air? I didn't even talk about he's 6'5", 247 pounds from Scottsdale, Arizona. He's 27 years old. He's in his fifth year in the league out of Oklahoma, third round pick in 2018. None of that may make air, literally none of it, but I've got to have it. It's got to be there. If the game goes south, then this might pop up and you might need a bit more on Mark Andrews. If he has 11 catches for 119 yards against the Buffalo Bills on Sunday, guess what? You're going to be talking about him a lot. You better have enough information to feel like it's fresh and you're not rehashing every single catch. So that's one player. Do that, multiply it. You're talking about 212 players if you're doing two games in an NFL week. And I do it by hand with color-coded pens and pencil and whatever I need to be prepared and to feel prepared. And that's wash, rinse, repeat. do it again next week, and then do it again the week after. And then the NBA starts, and I might have four games in a week for the NBA in four different cities. So you can imagine now how much work goes into that in terms of the preparation. And then, by the way, being judicious in when you use that information. I think something I learned, I don't know, probably year five, six, seven, after doing this for enough time that you should be learning how you handle your craft, not wedging things in, not forcing information based on the fact that I did all this work, only if it pertains to what's happening out there on the court or out there on the field. When you start spewing stats or spewing background information just to show how much work you've done, then you're doing the listener and the viewer a disservice. So being smart and being measured in when you use that information is also a huge key.
Well, and I would think the listener or viewer knows that too, right? It's you've got a very sophisticated audience that they don't want to necessarily be impressed by you. They want you to right?
No doubt. No doubt. If it's an assault of your senses,
yeah,
I'm like any other viewer or listener out there. I watch sports at home. I listen to sports in my car. I know when I'm being beaten over the head with information or nuggets or factoids that don't necessarily fit in what's happening in the broadcast. Ultimately, what's the goal? The goal is to provide information and entertainment and to keep it moving. And by the way, the goal as an announcer, at least it should be, don't get in the way. If the drama is unfolding, if the game is being played at a very high level, if there's a lot of meat on the bone, mm-hmm. then you should do less. The action will speak for itself. That doesn't mean that you completely turn your mic off. It just means that you have to be a little more selective and you have to recognize efficiency, being efficient in what you say, being economical in how you use your words and how you punctuate moments. And that comes with experience. It's not necessarily something that you can teach. It really becomes a feel thing and an instinct that over the course of doing many, many games, thousands, literally thousands of games, you begin to understand how all of this works and what the audience needs. Ultimately, that's your goal. Your goal is to serve the audience, serve the listener and viewer. And if you're not doing that, if you're not asking yourself, would this be interesting to me if I were at home or if I were listening in some other location, then you're not being thorough.
You had two parents that were entertainers. Do you think they strongly influenced you to go into a form of show business, which, you know, a play-by-play man, that's showbiz.
Yeah, I was 8 years old when my parents asked me, separately, by the way, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I wanted to be a sportscaster. And each of them said to me, well, then that's what you'll do. To get that kind of positive yeah. reinforcement wow. and feedback yeah. at that young an age, that changes everything. That changes your whole perspective. So at eight, I've already determined in my mind, oh, I'm going to do that. If anybody ever asked me, if it ever came up in conversation, I would say it. And most people would laugh it off or dismiss it. Oh, yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what you'll do. And that was my focus. What did I do about it? Look, this was in the 70s. There were no high school radio stations. There were no internet possibilities. There were no real options other than to take it all in, to become a student of it, to watch the sporting event with a critical ear and listen to, at the time, Marv Albert calling the Knicks and the Rangers and NFL games on NBC and eventually NBA games on NBC and listening to Dick Enberg and his call of the Final Four. And we can go on and on. Summerall and Madden and Al Michaels and Vern Lundquist and the guys that made an impression on me on a national level locally. I grew up a huge Mets fan in New York. Bob Murphy was the radio voice of the Mets, very distinct style in the way that he presented the game. And it sticks with you. It it really does resonate, and you don't even know it at the time that you're eventually going to probably mimic or copy all of the people that you heard growing up. When you start doing it yourself, when I show up at Syracuse for my freshman year, I'm just doing a bad imitation of Marv Albert, or a pretty good imitation, depending upon how you view it. But the whole staccato delivery that he had, that's what I just thought play-by-play was. That was, to me, the handbook, the guide in which you would follow to do play-by-play. Eventually, you develop your own style. You develop your own voice. But yeah, my parents were very instrumental in me even believing that I could do it. Their belief in me went a long way. My dad was a stand-up comic. He was an actor. He was a musician. My mom was a singer and an actress. I saw them perform night in, night out in the Catskill Mountains at Grossinger's and the Concord Hotel and Homowack and Brown, Stevensville, the Neville, you name it. Any of those places up there, I saw them over and over again. And that also plays a big role in believing that you can go out and do it, go out and perform in some way. That planted a seed, no doubt, and it injected me with a form of confidence that when the red light went on for a camera or a microphone, that I was not going to be intimidated by the moment.
Fantastic stuff. Ian Eagle joining us on Musings on Sports. You mentioned your folks and the impact that they had on you. And then, as you also mentioned, Syracuse University, along with the likes of Mike Tirico, you're among many outstanding announcers who were part of the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey, Ian, what was it like going through that college experience, announcing football, basketball, lacrosse games for your student-run radio station? It had to be an unbelievable experience and some ridiculously crazy fun stories that came out of it.
Yeah, Kelly, it was very competitive, and that was part of the reason why I went there. I wanted to be pushed. I wanted to be in an environment that brought together young people that had an aptitude for this or an interest in this. And then the randomness of life, where you can't predict what's going to happen. I showed up for my sophomore year. My freshman year, I definitely took advantage of being out on my own up at Syracuse and not having very much supervision. And while I was focused on trying to make a go of this, I joined a fraternity. I was very social. And that year went by without me making the kind of inroads that I probably should have made. But that's the balance of life. There was something that I needed to fill a void for in my first year of college. So I show up for my sophomore year, and I'm very serious now about trying to get this rolling. And I go to a high school football game, cover it for one of the student radio stations up at Syracuse, Z89. And I go with a friend of mine. We're going to cover it together. And who is on the sideline but Mike Tirico, covering the game for the local CBS affiliate in Syracuse. He had just gotten the job as the weekend sports anchor at WTVH in Syracuse. So my friend, who was probably a little bit forward, more forward than I was, a friend of mine from Chicago, says, "Oh, that's Mike Tirico. I've seen him on TV." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's nice." He said, "Well, let's go say hello." I was like, "Nah, we don't have to bother him." He says, "No, he'd love to hear from us." So we walk over and he introduces himself. And Mike, much like you would think today, he was the same back then. He extends his hand. He says, "Where are you guys from?" I said, "Oh, I'm from Queens, Forest Hills." He said, "Oh, I'm from Bayside," which is only about a 10-12 minute drive from where I grew up. So we immediately hit it off and bond over this commonality of just being from the same general area. And we talk, the three of us do, for a good 30, 45 minutes. And at the end of it, he says, "Hey, would you guys like to come see the television station at some point?" We said, "Yeah, that would be great." We followed up. We showed up. I ended up becoming his intern that year, my sophomore year. Then again, my junior year. By my senior year, I was helping produce his sports casts and helping to produce his radio show, which was on every Sunday. And when he couldn't do the radio show, I would step in and do the show for him. And a long-term relationship formed based on that random meeting at a high school football game. Now, little did we know at that point, he was one day going to be the host of the Olympics on NBC and one of the best sportscasters in the country. But what I did know in meeting him that first time was he was incredibly friendly and engaging. Yeah. Yep. And his success did not shock me at all because of the kind of person that he was back then and he is today. So I just think you never know when you roll out of bed what life is going to bring you and what turn it's going to take and who you're going to meet. And that's why you have to bring a positive attitude and you have to approach things with a sense of wonder, with the idea that, hey, life's unpredictable. So be open to all the possibilities.
You teamed for quite a while, Ian, with the great Dan Fouts for many years on CBS. Any stories that stand out during your time next to Mr. Fouts?
Well, we spent 10 years together at CBS, and I would tell you that we laughed for 10 straight years. We just really enjoyed one another's company on the air and off the air. We did our first game together. We had the Raiders at the Titans, had never worked together before. And Dan and his wife, Jerry, who are both just wonderful people, they have put on a show in Oregon, his wife has, for charity with different musical acts, mostly country music of that genre. And he would have country music acts come to the booth and sit in on our broadcast. Lyle Lovett was there, and Vince Gill was there. There were a lot of big name artists that would stop by. So if I recall correctly, I believe it was John Hyatt came in for our first broadcast. He asked me before the broadcast, Dan said, hey, would you mind if somebody sits in? I said, no, it's not a problem. We literally had not worked together prior. And the guy puts the headset on, John's listening, and we wrap up the first quarter of the game, first quarter that we did together, and we all take the headset off. And you know, Dan turns to John, and John says, so you guys been doing this, what, like 6-7 years together? And Dan says, no. That was the first quarter we've ever done together. He goes, oh, my goodness. It just sounds like you've got instant chemistry. And we did. We just had instant chemistry from the day we met. We got one another. We got each other's sense of humor. And the whole approach and philosophy of broadcasting we shared. And I really believe we made each other better based on our personal relationship that then translated on the air. There was just a comfort zone. He's one of my best friends. He's a truly great guy and a great broadcaster. And I was really, really lucky to work with someone like Dan for all of those years.
Hey, Ian Eagle with us on Musings on Sports. I've got to ask you, You do with NFL games, you meet with coaches and players before yep. games, the day before, what have you. And that's been the standard for years and years. I'm wondering if there was ever a moment, one of those meetings where a coach or a player said something that you didn't expect to hear that really surprised you, and maybe you weren't able to use it during the broadcast or on radio, but it was really something that kind of caught you off guard, because I would imagine so many of those are rather sort of plain coach talk, but did you ever get something unexpected?
Oh, sure. I think what ends up happening when you have a team over and over again, and a certain trust level is built between either coach and broadcaster or player and broadcaster, not in one season, over multiple seasons, 5, 6, 10 years, yeah. You often can go down roads that you would not expect. And sometimes those production meetings can turn into therapy sessions for some players and for coaches, by the way. You sometimes forget that they're so locked in on what they're doing, they don't have an opportunity to get some things off their chest during the week. There isn't someone to talk to. And those are done without cameras, without microphones. It's a pen and a pad. It's old school. And if a player or coach says, hey, not for air or off the record, you know that's not for air and it's off the record. You drop your pen. It's a human moment. It's a real moment. So, yeah, you name it. Over the last 25 years, my 25th year doing the NFL on CBS, you name it, I've met with them. I've talked to them. And some relationships are closer than others. Some are, you know, definitely more transactional, where a coach comes in, he does his 15 minutes, he gives you five things to look for in the game, and he turns around and walks out. Others become more of a close connection, and you go beyond the obvious, and you crack the veneer a bit. But yes, there have been many moments with the likes of Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and many others that they give you a little bit more insight and a little bit of the stuff that isn't necessarily covered on a broadcast, but gives you a better sense of the human being.
You know, you're so good at everything you do, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, what is the toughest sport for you to call?
Yeah, Bob, I think for me, each sport brings a different challenge, and I try to take that challenge on head on. Many years ago, 2000, I got a call from CBS, and it was a woman in their talent department, Amy Sackler. And I picked up the phone and she said, hi, and it's Amy Sackler. I said, hey, Amy, how you doing? She said, hey, you do boxing, right? So that's a leading question. What are you supposed to say to that? And I said, yeah, I do the hell out of boxing. Absolutely. She said, great. We have four fights and we want you to be the play-by-play announcer on the four fights. I said, oh, that sounds good. She said, Mike Arnold will be producing. And if you need anything, just reach out to him. I said, okay, you got it. So I hang up the phone and then I pick it right back up and I call Mike Arnold and I said, hey, Mike, just send me whatever you've got on boxing, whatever tapes. This is still back in VHS days. So he sends me, you know, literally 100 hours of boxing tapes of Tim Ryan and Gil Clancy calling the fights on CBS. Oh, sure. And I just sit back and watch it religiously. Every day I would watch 4 to 5 hours, jotting down the vernacular, getting a sense of the timing, and just doing a basic do-it-yourself course on how to call boxing. And I was a fan of boxing, so I had a working knowledge of it and understood the glossary of terms. So I show up, fly to Vegas for the first fight. It's David Tua against Obed Sullivan, two heavyweights going at it. And the executive producer at the time, Terry Eward at CBS, happened to be there. He was there for a convention that had nothing to do with the boxing event. So he calls me up. He says, hey, I want to invite you to lunch. So we go to lunch. We sit down. It's the day of the fight. We go to the MGM Grand. He gets a Caesar salad. I got chicken wings. I eat like a 12-year-old still to this day. I'm eating my chicken wings. And he says, well, give me your background. Tell me what your background is on boxing. And at this point, I'm doing the fight. The fight's in like 6 hours. So I said, Terry, I said, look, I want to be honest with you. I've never done a fight. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. I said, look, I want to be frank. I've never been to a fight. And now I see like little beads of sweat forming just above his lip. And then he said, really? And I said, Terry, I'm going to put all my cards on the table. I've never been in a fight. Which wasn't completely true. Like somehow in fifth grade, to this day, I still have no idea how or why. I was just walking through the hallways and someone came up to me, a young man, Scott Brigham, said, hey, I heard you're fighting James Schneff after school. I said, am I? I had no idea. And lo and behold, I was fighting James Schneff after school. And he was much taller than me. I closed my eyes, one punch. It was cold out. It was snowing. And I had gloves on. I connected with his chin. He went down. I walked home. That was the end of it. But
undefeated.
For the sake of the story, I said, yeah, I've never been in a fight. And now he says, well, what the hell are you doing here exactly? I said, no. Don't worry. We're good. I'm fully prepared. Meanwhile, I show up at the fight and Obed Sullivan gets knocked out in the first round by David Tua at maybe the minute four mark, and it's over. And a couple of things hit me. One, I'm sitting there ringside as I'm getting ready, and I've got my CBS blazer, I've got my shirt, I've got my tie, and I've got a cup of water there. And I realize everybody ringside is covering their water with a piece of cardboard. I was like, that's a weird boxing thing. What is that? And after a flurry in the first round, I realized why. Because Obed Sullivan, whatever was happening inside his face with mucus and blood ended up in my drink and on my shirt and tie. So it was an indoctrination very early into the world of boxing. To answer your question in the most roundabout way, Bob, any sport that I get assigned, I immerse. And same happened for track and field. I had never been to a track and field event in my life. And I ended up calling eight straight NCAA outdoor track and field championships on CBS until they lost the rights to ESPN. And I really enjoyed it. I look back now and remember how much fun I had every year in different locales, Austin, Sacramento, Fayetteville, Arkansas. We bounced around from Des Moines, Iowa, and it was a lot of fun. So I just look for the joy out of it. And I try not to view it as this is going to be too difficult. I always wanted to say yes. I never wanted someone to call and make an offer where I said, no, I don't do that. I just made a vow to myself early in my career that I'm just going to say yes, and I'm going to figure it out.
Ian One Punch Eagle. This has been absolutely, this has been fantastic. Hey, closing question for me, and then we'll let you go. You talked about immersing yourself and the preparation. I would imagine to have your son Noah, also a Syracuse grad, immersing himself, play-by-play announcer for college football on Fox, doing some radio work for the LA Clippers. And then I see that your boy even teamed with Dan Fouts and LaDainian Tomlinson for the Chargers pregame, preseason games this season. How very cool must that be?
Oh, beyond cool. Very surreal in many ways, because Noah has not only decided to enter this field, but has ended up doing a bunch of things that I've also done in my career. So now the level of conversations that we can have beyond father and son, which are always top notch, but now colleague to colleague, and the fact that he can relate to what I was doing all those years when he was growing up and waiting for me to come home after a long week on the road. It's just amazing. And he's a great young man, which is the most important part. He understands how all of this stuff works. And I think because he saw me doing it and literally would be next to me during football games or basketball games, it injected him with a sense of confidence that, oh, yeah, this is attainable. I can do this. And because he got this crash course on a daily basis of how to prepare and how to get ready for these broadcasts, he's not intimidated at all by the idea of big events and working with Hall of Famers or former coaches or former NBA stars. So the full circle moment with Dan was incredibly special, just because of the relationship I have with Dan and the fact that Noah met Dan for the first time when he was 13 years old. So to then be in the booth and share the booth and to then speak with Dan and speak with his wife after the fact and how impressed they were and blown away. And I think they're both concerned that there might have been some form of cloning involved that the government might investigate The kid has all of the same mannerisms that I bring to the table. So there are some some concerns that I would put to rest right now. He was born natural childbirth. This was not any chicanery whatsoever.
Well, Bob and I will do some looking into that. Trust me on that, Ian.
Do not investigate, please. Let it go.
This has just been terrific. Ian Eagle, continued good luck with everything you're doing, from the NFL to the NBA with the Brooklyn Nets on the YES Network, college basketball, and on. Ian Eagle, absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Sports.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Bob, I was honestly surprised. I didn't anticipate Ian Eagle being as great a storyteller as he is. But again, coming from a family of entertainers, I should have expected that. He was terrific.
Yeah, there was no doubt. As I said at the top, very impressed with his preparation and his knowledge and his enthusiasm. He's been doing it for quite a while as one of the key personnel at CBS Sports. And he never loses his desire. To him, I guess he got it from his father. You know, when you're a comedian, you go on that stage, you got to perform. And I think Ian Eagle, when that mic switch is thrown, he's ready to go and he gives it his best. And as a result, he's certainly one of the best.
Well, we thank Ian Eagle for his time and his insight and his stories. Really enjoyed hearing from him. Next week, an interesting guy, Bob Iback, is going to be joining us. Bob's a former PR director for the Chicago Cubs, former newspaper guy, a guy I've known for a long time. Fantastic stories. You talk about a great storyteller. He has a Michael Jordan free throw shooting story that I know our listeners are going to love. Done a lot in golf. Bob, you and I know that sport quite well. Really enjoyed listening to Bob Iback.
Yeah, very, very informative interview, and guarantee you, Musing on Sports listeners are going to enjoy Bob Iback.
Thank you all again for listening to Musings on Sports. Bob, always great being with you and visiting as we move forward through the fall season. Enjoy Musings on Sports wherever you listen to your podcasts. Kelly Elbin signing off along with Bob Bupka. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Sports.